is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
This is our time as Tanzanians, as there's no COVID-19, Magufuli says. He adds that Tanzanians should use the opportunity to grow many crops so that for countries that will experience famine, we will set the prices of their products and sell to them.
That was Tanzanian President John Magufuli, who has refused to admit the presence of COVID-19 in his country. Details coming up. Also, Ugandan police use excessive force on journalists who were covering singer-politician Bobi Wine. And thousands of Algerians take to the street demanding political change. All these and more ahead on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. South Africa has been the country's worst affected by coronavirus on the continent so far, registering almost 1.5 million infections and almost 50,000 deaths. But a new scientific study suggests that these rates are actually far higher. Darren Taylor reports.
The South African National Blood Service, or SANBS, has tested the blood of thousands of people across four provinces. So many tested positive for COVID-19, says principal investigator Marion Vermeulen. It suggested actual infections could easily be 10 times higher than the official figure.
If there are no further mutations that specifically mutate in areas where the antibodies have problems in binding, then I think, yes, it is good news, because then I think we will have some level of immunity. And if more and more people have immunity either from natural exposure or from the vaccine, then we should have a smaller third wave.
But before South Africans start celebrating, says the scientist, they should heed what happened after a similar study in Manaus, Brazil.
They had a very high seroprevalence, in fact, even higher than what we are finding around about October last year. They thought that they hit herd immunity and they were fine, and then had a huge second wave because their second variant, in fact, is very, very similar to our second variant, and it had this mutation on the 484 gene, and that stops the binding working properly of the antibodies, and then immunity was not actually there.
South African scientists say the risk of another variant emerging in the country in the near future is very real, as it is across the world. In the SANBS study, says Vermeulen, more black blood donors tested positive for COVID-19 than white participants.
We don't know what it necessarily means. What we do know is that there's no evidence internationally or locally that suggests that a specific race group is more susceptible to COVID-19. However, there has been strong evidence that inability to social distance and adhere to the COVID preventative measures, non-pharmaceutical measures, that is associated with high COVID transmission.
She says she strongly suspects that more black people tested positive for coronavirus because many live in overcrowded conditions where it's so much easier to get infected. Vermeulen says it's great news that relatively few of the potentially millions of people who've been infected haven't become ill enough to even visit their local general practitioner, and comparatively few people have died, despite high infection rates.
We need to be careful. I think we still have to make sure that we do everything that we're supposed to do. We wear a mask, we social distance, do all of those things, because we just don't know what the virus is going to do.
South African medical scientists have welcomed the SANBS study, but some say its findings are actually very conservative, and that up to half of South Africa's population of 60 million has at some stage had COVID-19. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Thousands of Algerians have taken to the streets in the northern town of Kahrat demanding political change on the second anniversary of the mass protests that started there and spread across the country. Algerian government tried to calm the protests by releasing more than 70 Hirak activists, but resorted later to iron fist practices to suppress the movement. William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, discussed the prospects of change in Algeria with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
No. In Algeria, we have protest movements over the last 33 years or so, and we have anniversaries of protests, such as the protests every year on October 5th that are the anniversary of the movement that brought down the first Algerian regime that was knocked out back in 1988. There's a lot of speculation among observers and in the press that, you know, this is the beginning of the next wave, but an anniversary protest isn't enough. Now, the Hirak never completely ended. It went virtual because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And Hirak was just the next national protest wave of the others. And what we will have at some point is probably not a Hirak 2.0, but some other reformulation of a mass popular protest. And we don't know what the trigger will be, and we don't know what the leadership will be, but it will probably be different. COVID-19 cuts both ways. It both suppresses the protest movement, but it also is a cause for whenever it erupts again. And the economy cuts both ways too. In Algeria, like in many other countries, it's often not when things are rough that you have the biggest protests, but when they start to recover and the protesters think they can get more by protesting, it's often at the moment of the turn, not the moment of the depression, because populations can be sympathetic with the regime if the feeling is that the economic downturn isn't entirely the regime's fault. So we just don't know what the trigger will be, but an anniversary is not a trigger.
Algerian government tried to calm the protesters by releasing more than 70 Hirak activists, but resorted later to iron fist practices to suppress the movement. What do you make of that?
That's the policy. Carrots and sticks, co-optation and coercion. These policies sometimes work in concert with each other and sometimes work at cross purposes. But there's always, from the Algerian regime and similar regimes, a mixture of palliatives and aggravators. And in the Algerian case, it goes all the way back to the independence movement of 1954 and how that dealt with the Algerian population through a mixture of co-optation and coercion when the entire population wasn't with them against the French. And it's unlikely to change until this regime goes, and until it's entirely replaced. There's another aspect of this, which is Tebboune himself is seen by the regime as somewhat unsuccessful, a casting error, that he's not the right man for the right movement. So there is a chance here that the plug will be pulled on Tebboune himself, on the Tebboune presidency, if he continues to be perceived as failing by the regime itself that's behind him. But we're not there yet now. Tebboune is continuing to have enough success to survive. If it takes a significant turn for the worse, then yes, he will be replaced not by the protesters, but by the regime itself.
President Tebboune has been in talks with the heads of political parties during which he discussed the possibility of dissolving the parliament and holding early elections. Would that satisfy the demands of the Hirak movement, which is the departure of the regime, the whole regime with all its components?
Absolutely not. Tebboune is playing the same game with the political parties that he plays with the Hirak movement. It's the same mixture of co-optation and coercion. And that overall strategy is one of divide and conquer. It's a regime strategy. It's an imperial strategy. And that's something the Algerian regime does with a lot of success, you know, over the decades. However, Tebboune can't survive without some sort of network of support or allies in the population. And most autocrats in autocratic systems, this is an oligopolistic system where there isn't one charismatic leader, but a leader named by the regime. And that changes over time. And whoever leads it tries to find allies in the regime and allies in the population. And the political parties are playing the same game. They work with Tebboune to survive, to be relevant, to gain advantages, to extract concessions from the regime on the issues that matter to them. So that's the give and take of politics in autocratic systems. The only thing that will satisfy the Hirak, of course, is a complete regime change where this cadre, this cohort of people running the country are all replaced and the rules of the game change to something that they would view as more democratic with more economic justice and social justice. And that won't be coming from this particular cast of characters.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawy. A new report finds internal displacement in the Middle East and North Africa has reached unprecedented levels a decade after the so-called Arab Spring triggered a political upheaval across the region. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Over the past decade, the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center reports the number of internally displaced people in the region has more than tripled, from 3.5 million to 12.4 million. During the same period, it says 7.8 million refugees and asylum seekers fled to other countries in search of safety. The manager of the Global Monitoring and Reporting Team at IDMC, Vicente Anzalini, says several factors have precipitated this high level of displacement. These include foreign intervention in regional civil conflicts, local conflicts sparked by ethnic, tribal, and religious affiliation, instability caused by extremists and jihadist groups, and natural disasters. Anzalini tells VOA displacement peaked in 2015 when Russia intervened in the conflict in Syria and when Saudi Arabia got involved in Yemen's civil war. Another factor behind increased displacement in the region, he says, was the expansion of the war waged by Islamic State militants throughout Iraq and Syria.
And then a counteroffensive led by governments and by the U.S. and by Russia really intensified these conflicts. And many of these conflicts took place in urban areas like Aleppo, Mosul, just to mention a few. And then, of course, these urban areas were home to millions of people who had to flee.
Anzalini says Iraq is the only country in the region where the number of displacements has gone down. He attributes this reduction to the defeat of Islamic State militants, which has allowed many people to return to their homes of origin. However, he notes many returns across the region are being hampered by a series of factors.
Many cities still have unexploited ordnance and booby traps, so all these remnants of war need really to be cleaned up before people can safely go back. There are no good mechanisms across many of these countries to really support IDPs returning in a safely and dignified way.
If current UN-led diplomatic efforts in Syria, Libya, and Yemen yield positive results, Anzalini says fewer people will feel the need to flee their homes. But he says the outlook remains grim for now, and continued conflict in the region is likely to trigger new displacements. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Tanzania's government insists there are no cases of COVID-19 in the country, but residents and doctors point to a growing number of illnesses and deaths. Opposition politicians say the government's stance is endangering lives. Charles Combi has the story from Tanzania's capital, Dodoma.
Nasa Kiwanga visits the grave of his daughter, Tuli, who died earlier this month. Tuli passed away in a hospital in Dodoma, Tanzania's capital, 1 week after falling sick. Doctors told her family she died of pneumonia, but Tuli's father, Nasa Kiwanga, believes his daughter died of
COVID-19.
What sent his daughter to the hospital, he says, was that she started having breathing difficulties when at home. After that, she was sent to the hospital on Saturday morning. Kiwanga says she lived for only 2 days with oxygen support, adding that when the oxygen finished at the hospital, the life of my daughter ended there. According to a doctor who asked not to be identified, Kiwanga is correct. His daughter died of COVID-19. Since the start of COVID-19 pandemic a year ago, Tanzania's government has refused to admit the presence of the coronavirus in the country. Instead, the country's president, John Magufuli, has portrayed the pandemic as an economic opportunity. This is our time as Tanzanians. As there's no COVID-19, Magufuli says. He adds that Tanzanians should use the opportunity to grow many crops so that for countries that will experience famine, we will set the prices of their products and sell to them. The government has not released any figures on coronavirus cases or death, making it impossible to gauge the true extent of the virus in Tanzania. But a few weeks ago, the U.S. Embassy in Tanzania warned that COVID-19 cases has risen considerably in the country since January. Meanwhile, Tanzanian opposition politicians such as James Mbatia, the chairman of the National Convention for Construction and Reform, are criticizing the government's position on COVID-19. Mbatia says he's one of the victims in his clan and their family. He says they had many deaths because of the problem. All of the symptoms are of the coronavirus. He asked that they requested testing and the results came out positive that it's the coronavirus. So, who are we deceiving? Mbatia asks. And why are we deceiving ourselves? Tanzania's health ministry has touted the use of traditional medicine in the fight against COVID-19 and other diseases. The ministry also backs the president's recent dismissal of COVID-19 vaccines.
Kwa sasa, wizara haina mpango wa kupokea.
For now, the government has no plans to receive the COVID vaccine being distributed in other countries, she says. Gwajima emphasizes that it should be known that the government, through the Ministry of Health, has its procedures to follow when you receive any health product, and this is done when the government is satisfied with the product, she says. Meanwhile, Nasa Kiwanga and his family are collecting his daughter's belongings as they prepare to leave Dodoma for his home in the southern highlands of Tanzania. Kiwanga says he worries about those who might suffer the same fate as his daughter, victims of COVID-19 that no one is allowed to admit. Charles Kombe, for VOA News, Dodoma, Tanzania.
Malawi will reopen schools on Monday, February the 22nd, 5 weeks after President Lazarus Chakwera suspended classes due to a surge in COVID-19 cases. Lamek Masina reports for VOA that Malawi's Presidential Task Force on COVID-19 determined it is safe to resume classes after a drop in the rate of infection.
Co-chairperson of the Presidential Task Force on COVID-19, Kumbize Kandodo Chiponda, said in a televised address Wednesday night, the infection rate is at 16%, down from 30% in January, when classes were suspended. She says, actually, what we wanted is that once we reopen schools, our children should be safe, because we know that when we were closing the schools, some teachers were COVID-19 positive and were on quarantine. So we wanted to give them enough time to recover. However, Kandodo Chiponda, who is also Minister of Health, said some schools will require students to produce COVID-19 negative certificates to be allowed into class. She asked parents to comply with such a requirement, saying the government has enough COVID-19 test kits in all public hospitals in the country. She says, I would like to ask schools with such a requirement not to suspend learners with the positive COVID-19 results, but reserve their places and give them enough time to recover. Critics say the decision to resume classes has been rushed, and many schools, especially in rural areas, are not ready to reopen. They say unmet requirements include on the campus water resources for hand washing and enough classrooms for proper social distancing when learning. But Education Minister Agnes Nyalonje says everything is set and that the ministry has allocated about $6 million for the reopening of schools. Nyalonje said part of the money will be used to drill 400 boreholes in primary schools and 240 in secondary schools to improve sanitation.
My ministry has made money available directly to schools through zonal accounts for them to procure soaps, to procure masks, to procure buckets where buckets need replacing, to make sure that when schools open, these things are in place.
She said the challenge is to find tents for additional classrooms in highly congested schools.
Because it so happens that globally, the scramble for tents is very, very high. But we are fairly advanced to get tents, and we're hopeful that we will find tents, and probably within a week.
Nyalonje also said the government has recruited 2,275 auxiliary teachers to ease pressure on permanent teachers. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
The United Nations is calling for an investigation into allegations that Ugandan military police attacked journalists with excessive force. The Associated Press reported that journalists were at the local UN Human Rights Office in the capital Kampala covering singer-politician Bobby Wine. He has been challenging the outcome of the January 14th vote that gave incumbent President Yoweri Museveni another term in office. Yesterday, in his complaint at the UN Rights Office, Wine cited alleged abuses by the Museveni government, including 243 abductions that took place during and after the election. Four local journalists were reportedly beaten outside the UN office. Witnesses say two suffered head injuries. Ugandan military spokeswoman Brigadier Flavia Baikwaso said on Twitter that the army regrets that some journalists were injured as security carried out its duties. Botswana's President Mokwetsi Masisi has called for regional cooperation in combating poaching as his country battles unprecedented cases. The country's black rhinoceros faces extinction as poachers from neighboring countries decimate the animal's population. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Mokandisi Dube has the details.
President Mokwetsi Masisi says the army should rise up and protect the southern African country's natural resources. Botswana has faced rising incidences of poaching, with the perpetrators mostly from neighboring Namibia, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. The poachers particularly seek rhinoceroses. An estimated 102 have been killed since 2018. President Masisi said poachers target soldiers, with one officer losing his life recently.
The number of poaching incidents, the tactics and boldness employed in targeting Botswana Defense Force members is not only disturbing, but a national security threat as well. This therefore calls for a robust and multilateral approach to combat poaching and related criminal activities.
Conservationist Map Ives believes poaching calls for the involvement of regional countries where most of the poachers originate.
There needs to be an international effort to deal with the trafficking and the demand in Asia. That is ultimately where the success will lie, is reducing the ability to traffic these rhino horns across international boundaries. It needs regional cooperation. We need a lot more intelligence.
Poachers hunt rhinos because their horns sell for thousands of dollars in Asia, where they are used in traditional medicine. The Botswana army has killed more than 20 poachers in the last year during gunfire exchanges in the thickets of the Okavango Delta, where most of the wildlife is found. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Habaroni, Botswana.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Ihayes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbiya Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 1705 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to Ndombolo and Makossa to Kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the interview.